In his new book, Gilded Rage, independent journalist and New York Times bestselling author Jacob Silverman delivers a searing expose on the radicalization of Silicon Valley, a peek behind the curtain at the tech and finance billionaires who are using their money and influence to steer a radical political revolution. As he follows men like Elon Musk and Peter Thiel from early days of PayPal and Palo Alto to Washington, D.C., Silverman uncovers a sinister world where moguls preach populist revolt while dismantling the few remaining checks on their influence. This is the book you need to understand our current political moment and how tech and politics have become dangerously intertwined. Gilded Rage is available October 7th from Bloomsbury Continuum. Get your copy wherever books are sold.
The old world is dying. The new world struggles to be born. Now is the time of monsters. With those words, I welcome you to the Time of Monsters podcast. I'm Jeet here of The Nation magazine. This podcast is sponsored by The Nation and widely available on all podcasting platforms. This week, we're recording on a Friday where the news that's sort of on the headline of The New York Times is that Secretary of War, as he calls himself, Pete Hegseth, is sending out an aircraft carrier, the Gerald Ford, to the Caribbean. And the Times correctly describes this as a major escalation. And it often does feel like over the last few weeks, we do seem to be in the run-up to some sort of war with the United States and the government of Venezuela. Like, to be perfectly honest, it is an actual war already, because if you're blowing the ships of another country in international waters, I mean, I'm sorry, that is an act of war. So to my mind, there's two big questions, like what is exactly going on? I think there's a variety of explanations, which we'll get into. And perhaps the other more curious thing is the famous Sherlock Holmes, the dog that does not bark. What does it mean if you're having a run-up to war and are no protests, or the opposition party, such as it is saying virtually nothing about it? So to talk about all this, I'm very happy to have on Van Jackson. He's a professor of international relations at the University of Victoria in Wellington, writes prolifically on foreign policy and podcasts as well, is especially focused on the United States in Asia. He is a co-author of a recent book, which I wrote about for The Nation, called The Rivalry Peril, dealing with the bipartisan consensus in favor of a new Cold War with China. I think that actually, that sort of bipartisan militarism might be a good way into this. I want to ask Van to just maybe, first of all, briefly describe like what is going on here, and then what are the possible explanations? How does this fit into a larger American politics of what one can see as a resurgent attempt to reassert American military power around the globe?
Yeah. I mean, first of all, thanks. I'm a big fan of your writing and of this show, a longtime listener. But the superficially, you know, the Trump administration obviously is marketing this Venezuela war as narco-terrorism. That's, of course, profoundly stupid, because 0% of like black market fentanyl comes from Venezuela. Almost yes. All of it comes from Mexico. You know, there's just like, that's an insane proposition. It's not serious. And then like the other day, Rubio, Secretary of State, he said, if people want to stop seeing drug boats blow up, stop sending drugs to the United States. And it's like, if that's your threshold for not doing illegal war, then you're basically saying you're going to be doing illegal war forever. Because there's never going to be a world where like drug supply doesn't meet demand. And
I mean, this is the classic sort of South American and Latin American perspective on this. Like, you know, we wouldn't be selling these drugs if there wasn't a market for it. And the United States is the world's biggest consumer of all sorts of narcotics. So, yeah, I mean, it seems like there's a kind of two-way street here That's not, I mean, I would actually ask a third point. This is a little bit of a digression, but I have to say, historically, if you want to prevent the drug trade, like starting an American war is not the way you do it. Because traditionally, the American military, you know, whether it's in Vietnam or Afghanistan or in Central America with Nicaragua, has been a gateway. And that's certainly true of this sort of current era of special forces, you know, like Seth Harp with his recent best-selling book on the Fort Bragg cartel. It happens to be the case that these special forces are a big conduit for the drug trade. So it seems like even on its own level, it seems like a paradoxical activity.
Yeah, no, it's insane. But I also think like, so Vincent Bevins had a thing recently where he wrote about like Trump administration, he said they're not seeking regime change, although they are, they're seeking regime collapse. And his distinction was that like there's going to be a power vacuum that results from the attempt at regime change, which is how it always goes. It's not going to go cleanly. You're not just going to have a democracy swoop in post Maduro. Like it's going to be profoundly devastating, destabilizing to the Western Hemisphere. And so they will call it a regime change insofar as they are just willing to be neocons. But like what they're really doing, and we shouldn't lose sight of it, is regime collapse. And the thing that's interesting about that is there's like somewhat like he's not wrong. I think there's something to that, or it's like just flatly correct. But it takes the Trump administration's own sort of rhetoric about this, like a little too seriously, like a little too on the nose. Like the idea that like the Trump administration is trying to solve a policy problem called drug trafficking, or that they're trying to solve a policy problem called immigration. Like that's not serious. That's not, they want to do violence, and they want to concentrate and wield the power of the state without fetters, with impunity. And that means existing in a state of exception. That means existing in like a continuous emergency condition, you know? And so you need to, like, this drug stuff is completely trumped up. The immigration stuff is completely trumped up, you know? Like, they need to inflate threats everywhere to justify emergency, to then therefore justify the use of state power. So they're not trying to solve problems. And it's like that's really important, because I see a lot of these critiques of the Trump administration, which are fair-minded, which say like, oh, the Trump administration is going to destabilize everything, and that's going to cause a flood of refugees and immigrants coming in across the border, of course. So it's an own goal. They're making their own problem worse. But yeah, but that's not a valid critique. That critique assumes that the Trump administration is actually trying to solve a problem. And it's not obvious that they are. It's actually obvious that it's the opposite. They need excuses for emergency politics, basically, you know?
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense what you're saying. I mean, it does seem like it's sort of pretextual, or, you know, the war is the solution itself. And then the extraneous ideological explanation are ways you get to that solution. I mean, the other thing I will add is, just in terms of the historical origins of this, the whole phrase narco-terrorism calls to mind two separate, you know, ventures that have created states of exception. One is the war on drugs, and the other is the war on terrorism. And this is like a ramping up or a use of this sort of existing ideological structure of the war on terrorism and the war on drugs to justify this position. So if we're saying like, you know, I mean, the goal is the violence is the goal, or the violence, you know, exists for its own sake. Like, what exactly?
There are still accounts that there are still ways to explain
that. What are the other accounts that are available?
Yeah, I mean, first, just to like reiterate the point you just made, what we're seeing, like what we're observing, is like the war on terror and the war on drugs and the war on immigrants. It's congealing into this jello fruit salad of death. You know, it's like that's the observation, right? That's the social science brain. That's the dependent variable. And then it's like, how do you, you know, and Venezuela is a key part of that. It's like the foremost site of that now. And so like, how do you account for it? And so the ideologue, like there is an ideological explanation here that has purchase, but it's not enough. So the Monroe Doctrine, it's an imperialist foreign policy doctrine. The 1904 version from Roosevelt is what MAGA has in their mind when they talk about the Monroe Doctrine, which is like, we are going to exclude other empires from colonizing this place, and we will do wars on behalf of that goal if we want to, under the guise of the Monroe Doctrine, right? And so that is kind of happening, and you can call that an ideology. And within the Monroe Doctrine, it's counter-socialism, pro-reactionary governments. And so regime change in Venezuela against a nominally socialist government, you know, in the minds of MAGA anyway, like that contrasts with the crypto-fascist Milei in Argentina, who they're pumping $40 billion into. Mm-hmm. And they're also opposed to Lula in Brazil, who's a kind of, you know, left populist. And so you start to see that, like, okay, Venezuela slots into a larger sort of anti-socialist, pro-far-right government, you know, set of policies. And so, like, there's a way that you could think of that as ideology. Rubio specifically, though, has been like the guy in the Trump administration who is trying to make all of this about great power competition. Mm-hmm. And so it's like, yeah, he's a right-wing Latino who wants regime change, you know, and he's sold the Trump administration. He's sold Trump personally on that from what I've read, but he's also trying to like graft all this Latin America imperialism stuff onto as like he's justifying it as like part of the global chessboard of great power competition. And because Venezuela is friendly with China, they broke diplomatic ties with Taiwan, you know, not so long ago.
Yeah, well, I mean, in the case of Rubio, I mean, it sort of makes a lot of sense in terms of his own ideological trajectory that he was the sort of favorite candidate of the sort of neoconservatives in 2016 and has that sort of old Republican Party, Bush era Republican Party kind of worldview. And there's a way in which he's Venezuela putting it as a, you know, part of the global chessboard against China is a way of solving the political problem of, combining Bush era Republicanism with the, you know, Trump's MAGA thing. It's a way of creating a popular front on the right along that basis. So I think Rubio's actions, as you described them, make a lot of sense from where he's coming from. Mm-hmm. In terms of MAGA, their own like ideology. I mean, I obviously anti-socialism is a big part of it. Mm-hmm. There's another component, which is this, which maybe I'm not sure if Rubio's on board with, and maybe his global chessboard is a way of creating wiggle room. But I mean, like the sort of hardcore MAGA people like Bannon, they do seem to, try to hark back to the old right Republican tradition of sort of hemispheric dominance. You know, not just the sort of Monroe Doctrine, but the idea that the U.S. should try to offshore in the Middle East and in Europe so they can concentrate on, you know, where its real assertion of power has to be, which is the Western Hemisphere. And one sees aspects of that in Trump. I mean, the sort of obsession with Greenland, annexing Canada, taking over the Panama Canal again. It is a kind of hemispheric vision. But that's an ideological explanation. I'm not sure that like that necessarily, you know, gets us where we want to be. But like, what do you think about that part of the worldview?
No, that's an important piece of this. And like, you're going to see, they've already been, you know, showing a lot of leg indicating that or foreshadowing that we're going in this direction of like, quote unquote, hemispheric dominance. The Monroe Doctrine 2.0 is part of that. And the forthcoming National Defense Strategy is also going to signal that sort of shift. But there's a kind of farce in that too, because who is challenging American dominance in the Western Hemisphere? You know what I mean? Like, there's nobody that comes remotely close. There's nobody who comes remotely close to challenging American dominance globally, galactically, interplanetarily, except for China. You know what I mean? And so the focus on Western Hemisphere, like that, it it's insufficient. You cannot justify that on its own terms. Like, what that kind of suggests is like a focus on quote unquote homeland security, which is a fascist term in itself. But the homeland is part of the Western Hemisphere. So it's like doing the internal war against yourself and on within North America. That is as much what the Western Hemisphere means to these guys as Latin America. I think for foreign policy nerds, we think Western Hemisphere, we tend to think like Latin America, but like this is as much about ICE and the war on immigrants as anything else, you know?
Yeah, no, I agree with that. I mean, wasn't there like this sort of controversy between Hegseth and the Pentagon in terms of, a divide over whether the sort of main adversary is China or whether it's like America itself? So I mean, there is a sense in which, like, yeah, if you see the Western Hemisphere as the United States and then its backyard and its ports like Canada and then Latin America, then yeah, if your main focus is going to be on, you know, the war within your own people, the, you know, reconquest of the United States itself, and then as a byproduct, asserting dominance over reasserting dominance or over the neighboring countries, like that seems to be like part of the vision at work here, right?
Yeah, and this actually gets to like maybe two different versions of a materialist explanation for this, which the first, and I think this, there's a lot to this again, resource extractivism. You know, Venezuela is the world's largest proven oil reserve spot. It's a country that's rich with deposits of gold and coltan and diamonds. And like prior to any of this Venezuela stuff coming to the surface, I had a kind of ongoing argument that the crisis of capitalism, which is in evidence everywhere, everywhere you look, like that it was going to be followed by a turn to not financialization. That's the most recent stage of the crisis, but actually primitive accumulation. Imperialist foreign policy is how you do primitive accumulation. And so, I mean, in Marxism, that has like some specific meaning, but I mean like primitive accumulation as like dispossession, settler colonialism, minerals extraction, ethnic cleansing, right? So that is in evidence in all kinds of parts of U.S. foreign policy, right? Ukraine, Panama Canal, ethnic cleansing in Gaza, West Bank settlements. Defense strategists that I know have been have been writing about doing this thing that they call minerals for military assistance as like a paradigm for doing deals all over the world, you know? So that's like in a world of declining growth, you have all this surplus capital. Where does it go? Where, you know, you have to unlock new surplus value somehow in a world that's generating less value. So surplus capital needs something. Primitive accumulation is a way of unlocking new value, but it's just in the most barbarous, horrific kind of way.
Yeah.
And so there's something to that because Venezuela is rich with resources. It seems a little crazy to me, like as if we invaded Iraq for the oil, you know?
Yeah, I mean that is the way like Trump at least like literally thinks about it. Like, you know, like, well, we didn't get the oil. He went in there, you know, like how stupid is that? And it does seem like I do think that like the primitive accumulation, like it seems to be like it's a way of getting Trump and then maybe some of his people on board. That I know that like, you know, when they were trying to keep the United States in Afghanistan in Trump's first term, they started to tell Trump, oh, there's these rare minerals in the Ukraine. And,
yeah.
And there's also a way which like the sort of Ukraine war has been sold to Trump that, you know, like the US can get like all these deals on minerals in Ukraine. So, but like on what level of reality, like does it like operate? Like, I don't know that like any sort of cost benefit analysis, the cost of going in there and seizing these properties, and like how do you like my mind can't quite get around the process. How would they actually do this? Like in a way that I like, you know, like I don't deny that they want to do this.
Like, yeah, and how much is it a driver? Like, of course, if you control the area, you can exploit it the heck out of it if you want. But is that really, like, as you're sitting around in the situation room and you're trying to, like, decide what to do, is that the thing that's going in your mind? Or is that just how you're appealing to Trump because you want to do it for other reasons, you know?
Yeah.
So...
It's a little bit uncertain about that. I mean, I don't deny it. I do think that there is something going on with, like, especially rare minerals. I mean, I think the current crisis with China kind of indicates that, given where things are heading with batteries and stuff like that, the U.S. might feel like there is a problem and there's a lack. And historically, I mean, you know, like, yeah, not necessarily direct control of oil, but, you know, access to oil supplies has been like a major part of American foreign policy. So clearly there's something to that. It's just like, is this really even like the best way to go about doing it? I mean, it almost goes back to like the old question about like, you know, war for oil. Like if you just wanted oil, Saddam Hussein was like more than willing to sell it to you, right? Like I'm sure that the regime in Venezuela would do like, you know, happy to be like sort of comprador, doing the sort of grunt work of resource extraction and get their own cut. But I mean, I don't know. I mean, like, there's something here, but I'm not quite sure I understand quite the mechanics of it.
Yeah, it raises more. It just like with oil in Iraq, it's not a non-factor, but it's not the. It can't be the primary factor because it raises too many other questions that go that are hard to answer. You know, but there is a more straightforward sort of. You could call this a materialist reading for Venezuela, which is like the spectacle of diversionary war while to distract from crashing the economy, you know, like it, in the same way that Republicans, they do a kind of like identity politics and culture war politics as a distraction from their economic agenda. So they wage class war, but they do the waging of class war partly through culture war stuff. You know, and the spectacle of like foreign wars and little military adventures can have that same effect. I mean, and
yeah,
and
yeah, so there's no, something... I mean, yeah, yeah, no, I think there, I mean, I, that seems to me has a lot of plausibility. And there's a long tradition of this, the sort of idea of the splendid little war.
Yeah.
And the sort of
again, you know, Roosevelt.
Again, Roosevelt. Yeah. But I mean, war as kind of like entertainment, bread and circuses. For the masses, but particularly, like, I mean, it ties in with the sort of larger crisis or anxiety one sees. And I don't think one sees this stuff as purely ideological or cultural, but, you know, like all the sort of anxiety about masculinity and, you know, declining testosterone, you know, the sense of, you know, like we need, like you know, men are on the way down, tied with America being on the way down. I mean, in the context of, I don't think people often ponder this enough, but I mean, Trump is coming in the wake of the United States, like, losing two, like, significant wars, like, really being unable to tame either Afghanistan or Iraq to their satisfaction. And, you know, like, a general consensus emerging that these, like, you know, very costly endeavors were like huge failures. And one sees this in Hegseth. I mean, this whole idea is going to remasculinize the military and, like, you know, like make it like tough again. So that, you know, and Trump himself has said, I mean, you know, like he has said that, you know, the United States has not won a war since like 1945, which is like, A, true, and B, something that like American presidents don't usually talk about.
Yeah. No, there's totally a feminist reading too of like, the libidinal need to deal death and conquer and dominate, you know? Very disturbing. I mean, one of the troubling things here is like, as Trump moves from bombing and drone striking boats in the Caribbean to what he calls land action or whatever, you know, it's hard to imagine that there's going to be large-scale troop deployments into the country, like occupying, like in Iraq war style. But it's totally conceivable that they're going to just launch a war from the air, you know, like just dropping bombs and drone strikes. And the idea, and if the goal is regime change, then you have a you know, coercion theory contest going where it's like you're trying to impose costs and pain on the people and on the government in Venezuela, rain down terror, basically, until something breaks internally in Venezuela, and then they feel the need to throw off Maduro or something like that. That is a wild theory of the case. I mean, like that, that's not how coercion works. Like, that is not a plausible goal. And so once again, you're committed to a course of action. Ironically, you're trying to win a war finally, because you haven't won one since 45. But that's if that's the standard, there is no way you're going to win this. I mean, like, you're not you're not going to bomb your way to regime change. That's never happened.
No. I mean, although I guess it has always been a strain of the military-industrial complex has fantasized about that, you know, a victory through air power or whatever. But yeah, I mean, historically the case that, you know, you can't like really affect anything unless you are willing to put troops, boots on the ground, which, I mean, you know, like Trump could, all indications are that he isn't. So it does become a kind of, you know, spectacle. Like, one has to be frank, like an incredibly costly spectacle. Like, you know, real people have already died, like in, and many more will die. Like, the sort of, you know, infliction of pain is real. But if it is all, but without, as you say, a coherent explanation as to like how this achieves your goal, then it is like something disturbingly like, you know, like a war just for show. And a war, I mean, something that you had tweeted out, which I think is maybe worth expanding on, is like the sheer pointlessness of it all, and the sheer like it is not. I mean, like, you know, like you know, I was of the age of being partially formed by the Iraq War, George W. Bush's war.
Same.
And you know, like at the time, like, you know, like it didn't make a lot of sense to me, but it was actually like much more coherent than what we're seeing now. Like, and it still had aspects of which they're, you know, even though they were violating core principles of international relations, they were still trying to make some sort of case based on human rights, the idea of an international order or consensus, in a way that, you know, of even like having allies, in a way that they're not doing now. I mean, both in terms of like not like having a case or having a coherent explanation, and then also like not even like, you know, bothering to make a case. They're not like going out there and telling the American people like this is the threat, they're weapons of mass destruction. Mm-hmm. We have to do it for, you know, like they're not even bothering to, you know, come up with an elaborate lie.
They have
a lie, but it's an incredibly shoddy lie, which they're not even trying to provide proof of.
Yeah, dude, there's so much in what you just said. So first of all, international relations scholar, like that's how I'm trained. They find all of this just totally confounding, because if your reference point, if your unit of analysis is like the nation state as a serious thing, as a real thing, this doesn't make any sense. Like, this is totally pointless if you have a conception of the national interest that you take seriously. And like, I'm critical, as any good leftist would be, of like these kinds of constructs, but like for international relations scholars, that's how they're trained. This all is just a profoundly confusing era, and this specific case of Venezuela is super confounding, you know, which is why it's important to reach for beyond the IR toolkit to materialist explanations and this kind of thing. But also, to your point about the Bush Iraq war comparison, my goodness, dude, the Bush administration spent like 18 months trying to sell us on Iraq WMDs, mushroom cloud, all this stuff. The Trump administration does not even care what we think. You know, like, they're not making an effort at all. They're happy to move the goalposts or like change their rationalizations, which is, you know, I saw Bannon the other day talk about like Trump 2028. And he was like, look, 2028 is going to happen for Trump. Is it unconstitutional? Well, we'll cross that bridge when we get there. What's the justification? Like, he's willing to reverse engineer the rules to get to the outcome that he wants, right? Yeah. And it's kind of like that. Like, the outcome regime change in Venezuela is what they want. And it almost feels like they're just kind of like, dude, what do I have to say in order to just keep going down that path? Mm-hmm. And so if you actually use their rhetoric as like a serious thing to analyze, you end up feeling crazy.
Yeah, no, I think that's right. I mean, what you just said about Bannon does actually remind me of the way he's sort of justifying a lot of the presidential actions, which he said was, you know, like after the first term, you know, we got together and, you know, we thought like, what's the best way to, you know, like achieve our goals? And they sort of, they said they coalesced around Article 2 and, you know, the idea that the president has the power to do all these things. And like, yeah, we don't need Congress, which is the way that they've been acting. But it is an approach to politics where like the sort of like outcome comes first and then you know, the rationale comes second. But I mean, I think within the domestic politics, though, like, as unpleasant as nasty as it can be, you can understand, like, you know, some of their outcomes. I mean, like, it is a sort of entrenchment of plutocracy, a self-enrichment of, like, their allies, sort of attacks on democratic cities and states, entrenchment of a kind of police state. But with Venezuela, like, it's absolutely not clear what it is that they hope to achieve, except a kind of, I mean, a feeling that they have to like assert dominance somewhere. And I really go back to the fact that, you know, like what Trump's statement that they haven't won a war since 45. Yeah. And I would add that, you know, this is coming not just in the wake of Iraq and Afghanistan, but coming in the wake of where, like, you know, in Ukraine, it looks like whatever settlement there's going to eventually be is going to be like, you know, like humiliation on some level for the United States, where they're going to have to like, and it's, you know, something I personally also find distasteful, that like Putin's aggression will be to some degree rewarded. And in the Middle East, where, you know, the one hand, Israel has inflicted huge damage on its enemies and perceived enemies, but is still the case that, like, after 2 years of horrific warfare, they're going to have to accept that Hamas is still going to control Gaza, that, you know, like, Yemen will still be under the Houthis, that Hezbollah is still there in Lebanon, that, you know, the Iranian regime is still there. Everything in the last 20 years, 30 years has shown, yes, we know they can inflict huge pain on the world, but can they actually subdue anyone or get anyone to, you know, like accept their legitimacy or go along with it? They can't. And like, to me, like, Venezuela seems like, okay, let's pick an easy target. Let's pick something. Let's find the lowest apple hanging from that tree.
Yeah.
And see if we can do that, right? In some ways, it seems like a kind of a, you know, like along with Hegseth, like push-up exercises, like a way of like, okay, let's just find something we can do and see if we can do that.
It's I think that's one of the most troubling aspects of this for me and for a lot of us, even though people wouldn't express it quite this way. This is just unbelievably elective. There's all these explanations like we just walked through for like why this is happening, but there is no reason why this has to happen. There's nothing forcing this to happen. It's like, other than their emasculated libidos. I mean, like, there's no, you know.
Yeah, no,
other country that's weak, and it's the same, you know?
Yeah, yeah. Well, I mean, like, to return to the Iraq war thing, I mean, there was a statement made at the time by, you know, the late Michael Ledeen, who's a kind of bigwig in that sort of national security world, where he, you know, famously said, you know, like, you know, every 5 or 10 years, the United States has to pick some crappy little country and, you know, shove it against the wall just to prove that it can, right? Yeah. And that sort of, you know, like these kind of displays of power that one saw, and, you know, like, yeah, they could win in Grenada, right? Like they could take out Panama or whatever. Like, but it does have that feel, because like up until like, I think this summer, like there was actually signs that they were working towards some sort of rapprochement with Maduro, that like, you know, like they had at least one envoy there who was like, you know, in negotiations with the regime. And there's like no indication that this was like coming. And then at some point, it does seem like, Marco Rubio just decided that, this might be a way for him to, reestablish his foreign policy credentials among Washington Republicans or whatever, and get the Trump administration to sign on to some version of great powers competition. And it is a totally, like, almost a ridiculous degree of war of choice, or a war that's sort of like arbitrary to a frightening degree. And I don't think I'm glad we're having this conversation, because I don't think that that's actually been like noticed or pointed out, but that does seem to be the case.
Well, think about the millions, like you and I mean, most people who are in the sort of elder millennial basket, we formed a politics and our imaginations around opposition to the Iraq war, partly because it was so egregious and just like blatantly not serving any kind of conception of security or the public good. But we did see millions of people show out in the streets to oppose the Iraq war. I don't think there's a single protest on the streets about Venezuela. And that is super, in some ways for good reason, because we have, more important, urgent, neighbors are getting kidnapped.
But if one sees this as a single unified hemispheric, struggle, like a assertion of dominance. And I think people in the United States are quite properly, if they're liberal, doing the sort of no kings thing, or, if they're a little bit more than that, what we're seeing in Los Angeles and California, these kind of organic protests against ICE that are like putting gears in the way of the machine. But it is the case. You're right, and I'm glad this is actually something I wanted to sort of end on or get to. I mean, there's like several aspects of this. One of which is, one has to say, as bad as the Democrats seemed in 2003, where Joe Biden and Hillary Clinton voted for the war, but they were still like half of the Democrats in Congress voted against it, and there were many people like even fairly conservative Democrats like Richard Burt who were like very outspoken against it. What we're seeing now is there's a few people, and I want to give credit here, like Ro Khanna and others in Congress who are speaking out against the bombings of the boats. But if one looks at someone like Chuck Schumer, who is the leadership of the party in Congress. First of all, doesn't ever bring any of this up voluntarily. Like, you have to like ask him. And then if he is asked, what he will say is that, there's a War Powers Act issue. Trump should come to Congress and involve us and
get our approval, and then you're good.
get our approval, which is like, this is like, one has heard this from other Democrats, like Spamberger, like it basically saying like, just let us rubber stamp this, I think a lot of the popular stuff, like if the leadership of the party is so silent on this, that's also gonna kind of like influence how things are going, and especially since there are many other foreign policy things going on, what do we say about this sort of general like silence and complicity? And I think especially in the case of Congress, the other aspect of the current era that this shows is just the complete degree to which Congress has been sidelined, even like to a much more so than like the classic Cold War or War on Terror period, where at that point we still thought about the imperial presidency and Congress being marginalized, but it was never like to this degree.
No, the Democrats are, as a party, are totally worthless. Like, they're a fake opposition. They're not really doing anything about any of these problems, and they're complicit in some of them. And like, I think if you have a kind of coherent account of things, if you're opposed to the strikes on Venezuela, if you're opposed to regime change in Venezuela, you also have to be opposed to ICE and vice versa. You also have to be opposed to the war on terror and the AUMF. And these things all go together. Like, the idea that you're going to like selectively oppose these things doesn't make any sense. Like, a coherent politics and a coherent platform would have to confront all of these things together. And so the idea that like you're going to oppose ICE in the streets, but not think twice about Venezuela, or that you're going to make a fuss about Venezuela, but you don't think that you're not particularly fussed about ICE kidnapping your neighbors. I mean, like, that's incoherence to me. That's mm-hmm. just like, if that's your politics, then it's opportunist or it's not thinking clearly or something. And the Democratic leadership is clearly not thinking clearly.
Yeah, no, they are thinking clearly. And I mean, like, to some degree, like, I wonder, like it to start a, like, a serious opposition to this stuff, like, on a political level, like, in terms of elected Democrats, one would have to, as you say, you know, have a broader view that, you know, incorporates the sort of, you know, war on immigrants. And it also incorporates, like, a real, I mean, I think a lot of this stuff illustrates this sort of unfinished business of the war on terror mm-hmm. and the war on drugs. But, like, all of these things have created a tremendous license for the president to do so. And it does seem, like, troubling that the Democrats don't want to raise this as an issue, because, like, to my mind, it sort of indicates that what they're thinking is, like, yeah, well, you know, this might not be great, but once Trump's out of the way, you know, we'll have our own president, and they'll want to have these powers, right?
Biden expanded ICE knowing that Trump could win and come back in. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
Yeah, no, we're part of the problem.
Yeah, no, I mean, yeah, it does seem like there's, I mean, that the decision to, like, avoid this does seem kind of very deliberate. And as I said, I mean, like, you know, like, it's not like there aren't other things going on. And, like, obviously for me, in terms of, like, foreign policy, I certainly spent a lot more time writing about the situation in the Middle East and, you know, Gaza, because mm-hmm. it's had an even, like, bigger kind of death toll, and you know, there's long-term implications. But there's something about this that is very troubling. The fact that, you know, one can have, like, send an aircraft, you know, be blowing ships out of the water in international water, then also be sending an aircraft carrier without a debate. I don't know, like, it's hard to think of a more perfect example of a kind of, you know, like, imperial decadence than that.
And it's like, the thing that I bend over backwards every time I get a chance to explain to people is, like, this whole, you're using gunboat diplomacy, using the world's largest military signal and aircraft carrier, the $1 trillion war machine, all this stuff, the national security, like, obsession, the beating heart of the American economy being all this national security spending stuff. This is why Americans have barren store shelves. The cost of everything is going up. You know, even, like, the AI stuff, which is causing spikes in electricity costs. It's the national security Keynesianism on which America's economy is based is why the welfare state is being starved. You know, it's like the economic insecurity and precarity that most people are experiencing, and, like, their lives are getting materially worse. That's because we have a $1 trillion war machine, and, like, making those connections and, like, unspooling that and, like, getting people to think about it that way, like, oh, look at how much my bread costs. And then we're sending this $30 billion communication tool to the Caribbean, you know? Like, do you think those are unrelated? They're very related. We just have to start, you know, thinking how to relate those things to people more.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that's a good note to sort of end on. I will encourage my listeners to check out Van Jackson's writing, because a lot of it is on this very topic, the way in which the sort of warfare state has, you know, distorts, like, all politics. And they can be found, it's the Undiplomatic Podcast, and also it's also a Substack. I want to once again thank Van Jackson for being on and speaking about all this.
Thank you. This was fun.